I recently watched a discussion between Richard Dawkins and Jordan Peterson. And if you don't know who they are, then Richard Dawkins is a biologist who is vehemently anti-religion and particularly anti the Abrahamic faith, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. He pretty much believes that religion is the cause of most of the evil in the world. Jordan Peterson is a psychologist who would call himself a Christian. The jury's out on whether he actually is or not. Both of these men are highly intelligent, deeply thoughtful, and very academic. In this particular conversation, they discussed some of the imagery in the Bible. And Peterson spoke about the biology of the dragon. Dawkins, being a biologist, wasn't having any of that at all. You can't talk about the biology of a fictional animal. And it was fascinating to watch the biologist, with almost no imagination and no concept of metaphor, and the psychologist, with really an overactive imagination, who finds metaphor and allegory in everything. Generally speaking, I think that Christians fall into one of two camps with regards to the book of Revelation. They either just find the imagery, the mystery, the secret codes, the unimaginable times and dates too difficult, and they shelve it. They put Revelation to one side and they try and forget about it. We Baptists tend not to follow a lectionary, that is a schedule of set readings for Sunday mornings. But those Christian denominations that do, you will find that Revelation very rarely crops up in the lectionary readings. The other way that people look at Revelation seems to be to allow their imaginations to run away with them. They want to work out precisely what it all means. Who or what is the beast with 10 heads? What does 666 mean? Does Babylon mean the Roman Empire or the European Union or something else altogether? And to be perfectly honest, neither of these approaches is particularly helpful. Revelation is a book in the Bible, inspired by God and therefore not to be ignored. But on the other hand, it's not to be obsessed over. It's not to become the be-all and end-all. Christians mustn't let these apocalyptic texts have too much influence over our worldview and our approach to life and faith. Jesus told his followers to love God and to love their neighbour. If those two things aren't at the very heart of our life and faith, there's not a lot of point in worrying about anything else. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at the beginning of Revelation, where John, the writer, wrote to seven churches in Western Turkey, to criticize, to praise, and to encourage. We don't know exactly when Revelation was written, but we can tell that it was written to a suffering, persecuted group of Christians who believed they were losing. They believed that God was losing. It might have been written during the great persecution of Christians throughout the Roman Empire under Caesar Nero. Alternatively, it may have been a period of a sort of general persecution, not a deliberate act by the empire, but just people not liking Christians and making life generally difficult for them. So perhaps some 60 to 90 years after the death and resurrection of Christ, the Christian church has lost its edge, lost its drive, lost its passion and enthusiasm. Now they are being actively persecuted, and many of them have lost all hope. To the Christians, it seems that the devil is winning. The devil is in control, and God seems to have forgotten that he promised that Christ would return and promised that he would establish his kingdom forever. The word apocalypse means unmasking or revealing. And John is trying to reveal to the Christians that there is far more going on than we can see. The battle between good and evil isn't just being fought in the physical human realm. It's being fought in the spiritual heavenly realm as well. Therefore, there is imagery and metaphor that we in the physical human realm can barely even begin to understand. And so, having delivered his message to the seven churches, John in chapter 4 finds himself in heaven, where he witnesses these fantastical creatures in this fantastical place, singing their unceasing praises to God. In chapter 5, he sees a scroll sealed with seven seals, seven wax seals. And this scroll seems to contain God's final plan for the world. In a loud voice, a mighty angel asks the question, "Who is worthy to open the scroll?" No one, either in the heavenly spiritual realm or in the human physical realm, is found worthy to open the scroll. And John is so utterly devastated that he bursts into tears. In the NRSV, "I began to weep bitterly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll." Remember what I've just said about the state of the Christian church at that time. And John here, in a way, represents the hopelessness of the whole church. There is no one worthy to read and to carry out God's plan. I was really fortunate when I trained at Bristol Baptist College that the principal was the Reverend Dr. Steve Finnemore, who is a well-respected scholar of Revelation. And one of the things he said is that sometimes in Revelation, the things that John hears represent his Jewish expectation, but what he sees represents the Christian reality. So a really good example of this is in chapter 7. John hears it announced that 144,000 people, representing the 12 tribes of Israel, will be sealed. That is his Jewish expectation. The 12 tribes of Israel will be saved. However, in chapter 7, verse 9, he looks and he sees a great multitude that no one can count, from every nation, all tribes, and all peoples, who cry out, "Salvation belongs to our God." The Christian reality, which he sees, an uncountable number from every tribe, tongue, and nation will be saved. And the same happens back in chapter 5 with the scroll. John is crying bitterly. No one is worthy to open the scroll. And an angel speaks to him, "Do not weep. See that the Lion of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." Verse 6, though, Then I saw a lamb standing as if it had been slain. He went and took the scroll. Then the creatures, the elders, they bow down before the Lamb and they sing their new song. You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals. For you were slaughtered, and by your blood you ransomed for God saints from every tribe and language and people and nation. The Jewish expectation, which John hears spoken by the angels, the Messiah is a powerful lion who will defeat his enemy in battle in order to seal the 12 tribes of Israel. The Christian reality, which John sees with his own eyes, the Messiah is a weak and vulnerable lamb slaughtered for the ransom of an uncountable multitude. In a few moments, we'll be taking communion together to remember together not a lion who came down from heaven and tore apart its enemies as if they were prey, but a lamb who came down from heaven, weak, vulnerable, merciful, who reached out in love to all people, and who, rather than taking lives like a lion would, willingly laid down his own life, slain for the salvation of those who would accept him. Then I looked and I heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. And in a loud voice they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever."